Welcome to Copyright Clearance Notice Podcast Series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It's Friday, September 20th, 2019. Every week we check in with Publishers Weekly for the latest news on books and reading. We are back today with Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer. Welcome to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So, Andrew, another week, another lawsuit, though at least this latest legal skirmish isn't over copyright. On Wednesday, the Department of Justice sued famous whistleblower and former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. DOJ is seeking to recover any financial gain Snowden receives from publication of his memoir, Permanent Record, which arrived in stores earlier this month. Tell us about that suit.
Yeah, that's right. So this week we learned that the DOJ filed suit against Snowden and they named his publisher Macmillan in an attempt to seize Snowden's share of the proceeds from his new memoir, which, as you point out, dropped this week. It's called Permanent Record. In the suit, U.S. attorneys argued that the manuscript was not submitted for review to the intelligence agencies that Snowden worked for, and that the publication violates non-disclosure agreements that Snowden signed in exchange for getting access to classified information. Now, Snowden is, of course, the National Security Agency contractor who famously in 2013 leaked a cache of top secret documents that exposed the U.S. government's domestic surveillance and data collection efforts. Snowden has since been living out of the reach of U.S. authorities in Russia.
And indeed, we can understand why DOJ might go after Snowden, Andrew, but why is Macmillan named in the suit, and what does it mean that they are?
So the suit doesn't seek to bar publication of the book, which of course would be absurd for them to try, but among the remedies it seeks, the DOJ is asking for damages for any proceeds that Snowden has already received. In other words, they want to try to claw back as much of the advance that was already paid to Snowden as they can, but good luck with that. But here's where it gets interesting for Macmillan, who were named in the suit. So they are not liable for any damages here. They're not really liable for any monies here. But the DOJ suit asked for a restraining order and an injunction that would compel Macmillan to freeze all assets in their possession relating to Permanent Record that belong to Snowden or his agents, assignees, anyone acting on Snowden's behalf. In addition, the government is asking for all the contracts between Macmillan and Snowden and his assignees and his agents, an accounting of all the proceeds Permanent Record earns, a description of all persons and entities with financial interests relating to Permanent Record, Edward Snowden, as well as the nature of those interests, and a description of the process of dispersing funds to Snowden. And of course, that means which banks they're using, probably. Now, to me, all of this seems awfully intrusive. And in the coming weeks, we'll know more about how Macmillan will choose to respond to these requests. But I would think that if the government wants to go after Snowden's money, they can do so. But on what basis can they use Macmillan in that process? I think that's a fair question. I think it would be chilling for any future whistleblowers should they learn that a major publisher like Macmillan would freeze their money or not give it to them and hold it for the DOJ without some kind of fight, and that they would share information about their financial dealings with their banks. Now, Macmillan didn't sign any non-disclosure agreements here, and they have a right to protect their legally signed author. So it's going to be interesting to see how they answer this suit, and we'll know more soon about how that's all going to shake out.
So even as we wait out the lawyers in the court, one outcome from the lawsuit that we can all but guarantee is more book sales. Is this effort likely to boost Snowden's book in the same way as did President Trump's own threat of legal action to block publication for Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that that's going to happen. In a statement, in fact, Ben Wisner, who's the director of ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project and Snowden's lawyer in this matter, said right out that he hopes the suit filed by the U.S. government will actually bring more attention and more readers throughout the world, which it appears to have already done. The book has already shot to number one on Amazon, passing some very big books, Margaret Atwood, for example, and Macmillan executives told PW they were already planning to go back to press. The first printing was 135,000 copies. Of course, the suit does remind us of January 2018 when Michael Wolff, when he dropped his book and Fire and Fury, and President Trump sought to bar publication. The first reaction CEO John Sargent said he told an audience at Book Expo was that, wow, we're going to sell a shitload of books. And indeed, Macmillan did.
And as you noted in your coverage this week in PW, Andrew, the Snowden suit is actually part of a bigger issue regarding agency review.
Yeah, and this is a good time to point that out, that the ACLU, along with the Knight First Amendment Center at Columbia University, is already challenging the constitutionality of the government's pre-publication review system, arguing that the current rules gives government officials far too much power to suppress speech that the public actually has a right to hear, and it allows them to make these unexplained censorship decisions that are influenced by, you know, any particular individual viewpoint or their access to power. And I think they have a point here with this lawsuit. Now, we can all understand the need for non-disclosure agreements at places like the National Security Agency and the CIA. But at the same time, these agency reviews of manuscripts often go well beyond. And indeed, they're given to these low-level staffers lots of times who have the power to censor information from publication. Note, these are not judges. These are staffers, often political appointees. So that's a big part of this thing, too. NDAs notwithstanding, I think we would all benefit from shining a brighter light on the process by which government employees can effectively be censored.
Well, it's late September, and it seems hard to believe, but in a few weeks' time, we both return to Germany for the Frankfurt Book Fair, Andrew. In Monday's issue, PW will feature its annual agency briefcase, a listing of hot properties agents will carry with them to the fair. What's your sense of how this year's Frankfurt is shaping up?
You know, I've been going to the fair for many, many years now, and I can say that, you know, maybe I'm a little biased, but I have really come to admire the Frankfurt Book Fair organizers and the work that they put into keeping the fair fresh and always evolving, and even sometimes challenging for publishers in terms of the professional program. They've really done a good job of keeping the Frankfurt Book Fair meaningful in an era when technology was, you know, at one point supposed to make books and book fairs, you know, a thing of the past. So that said, what's my sense of the 2019 fair? You know, business as usual. You know, we've had three positive, pretty high energy, very well attended book fairs in a row. After years of declining attendance, things have really stabilized. Now, will professional attendance ever get back to its old levels at Frankfurt? Probably not. The book business has simply changed too much. But attendance, as I say, has stabilized. And remember back when the digital transition kind of loomed very ominously over the fair? I think those days are coming to an end. That was the theme, in fact, of the very first speech delivered at Frankfurt last year by HarperCollins UK CEO Charlie Redmayne, who in his opening keynote at last year's Markets, which is, of course, the pre-conference to the Frankfurt Book Fair, said that clearly the physical book was never going away. And he went on to suggest that, you know, the digital media landscape today doesn't have to always be seen as competition. You know, the publishers are actually now, we see, benefiting from this explosion of digital content. Ultimately, Redmayne said, it drives people back to the book. And also, we see that consumers now, especially in the app world, have demonstrated that they really are willing to pay for content as long as it's the content they want, the quality they expect, that it's accessible on all the platforms they want to consume it on, and very importantly, at the right price.
Well, that is good news, of course, which is not to say that publishers don't face challenges as they head to Frankfurt in 2019.
Exactly right. And lots of challenges, too, not the least of which fair director Jürgen Booz told me is this very unstable political world we now live in. But in recent years, the fair has actually tended to feed off that political uncertainty, especially in terms when it comes to things like, you know, defending free speech and the right to publish and pushing for more diversity, cultural diversity as well amid this troubling wave of nationalism that seems to be sweeping, you know, all parts of the globe. But, you know, this year, I think the challenges facing the Frankfurt Book Fair and publishers heading there are more economic. You know, we've heard much about the print book stabilizing. Charlie Redmayne spoke about that last year, but he also pointed to the other side of the coin. You know, yes, print has been holding steady, but we're not seeing any great resurgence in print either. And in fact, you know, what Redmayne called it last year, he said, the truth is, I think we have arrested decline. Now, that's a great phrase, arrested decline, but it may not be the most inspiring of phrases. Nevertheless, that is the backdrop, I think, against which publishers head to Frankfurt this year. You know, fairgoers last year spoke of a fair with the sort of almost very welcome business as usual vibe. Michael Bashgar, who's the publishing director for UK-based Canelo, described it as a mixture of bullish confidence and strange unease. You know, but something tells me that given world events this year, most attendees would sign up for another year, another fair that was just like last year's, you know, just sort of business as usual. Of course, We're not going to get that this year. This year, we're facing tariffs and trade wars and unpredictable policies coming out of the U.S. And we have political chaos in the U.K., which is going to be hurtling toward action on Brexit right around the time of the fair. So, you know, uncertainty is never good for business, certainly not good for publishing. But I think that's the primary challenge the publisher is going to be contending with at this year's fair is uncertainty.
And how are fair organizers handling that uncertainty, that same set of challenges you described, Andrew? What's their plan to keep momentum going?
Well, I think they're putting their heads down and they're working to identify the kinds of trends and market opportunities that can actually lead publishers to growth. New markets in Asia, for example, that's expanding a lot of opportunities. And we have a number of new agencies and new markets coming to the fair this year. And as we've talked about a lot on this podcast, one area of massive growth for the publishing industry has been digital audio, so much so that audio publishers are actually going to have a home of their own at the fair this year, located in Hall 3.1. That's going to be known as the Frankfurt Audio. And the Frankfurt Audio Summit returns this year, too. It has another strong slate of speakers, including Spotify's Michael Krauss, who will deliver the keynote. Technology, digital, streaming, all these things are going to be hot topics this year, so much so that the Global 50 CEO talk isn't going to feature a publisher. This year, we're going to be interviewing Kelly Lugenbeil, who's the Netflix's VP for International Originals, and we're going to talk to her about all kinds of things, everything from Netflix's appetite for original international stories to how it pursues book rights for its productions and programming. You know, and it speaks to Redmayne's point about this explosion of digital content actually creating opportunities for publishers. There's also a new speaker series I'm actually eager to see this year. It's a series that should inspire and challenge publishers. It's dubbed Create Your Revolution. This program is going to host talks with what Frankfurt organizers call global change makers. And, you know, among the speakers they've announced so far, pretty good. They have actress and producer Gina Belafonte, Ethiopian web and mobile tech developer Batalam Desi, and Taya Yuglo, creative director for Google's Creative Lab in Australia. Jürgen Buse, in an interview with me, said the Creative Revolution is about the importance of culture. And he said that, you know, the more that trade agreements begin to fail, the more that cultural and political movements start to fail in different places around the globe, the role of the cultural and creative sector becomes that much more important. And, you know, that seems about right to me.
A remarkable notion indeed. In 2019, the book, A Technology Hundreds of Years Old, still matters. Andrew Albanese from Publishers Weekly, thanks for joining me today and every Friday on Beyond the Book.
My pleasure, as always.
New and powerful digital technologies are great for business in many ways. Going digital can certainly help organizations to market better their products and services. Yet digital is at its most transformative when organizations use it not to sell, but to solve customer problems. In the new book, Designed for Digital, out next week from MIT Press, Jeannie Ross, principal research scientist at the MIT Sloan Center for Information Systems Research, unrolls a blueprint for digital success. She says it's not about restructuring or about IT architecture, though both are important.
I think it's important to focus on the capabilities of technologies rather than the technologies themselves. And I think the thing that these technologies, and here I'm talking about social, mobile, analytics, cloud, Internet of Things, the AI, the blockchain, that whole list of technologies, the three things they do is A, they give us ubiquitous data, which basically means there is nothing we can't know. So when we're trying to imagine what we can do for customers, we should start with the premise that if there's something we need to know, as long as we have a value proposition, we can find a way to get that data. It's ubiquitous. The second thing is we have unlimited connectivity. And that means not only can we get that data, but we can get it as it happens, as things occur, and we can resolve issues, we can distribute new information pretty much instantaneously because we have IoT and we have mobility. So there's a way to react to the data and the analysis that we can do. Finally, we have massive processing power. Because of that, we won't be overwhelmed by our data. We can take it, we can process it. This is why AI is a real possibility now. So we have unlimited data, unlimited connectivity, unlimited processing power. It means we can do things that were absolutely not possible in the past business environment.
Designing for Digital, next on Beyond the Book. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.